Good morning. It is May 8th, 2011. Happy Mother's Day. Apologize for my voice. I kind of started losing my voice over Shabbat. It's actually on the upswing now. So don't adjust your radio if my voice sounds a little bit off. Welcome back. We haven't done this in a while. From Pesach, we had a few weeks. Yeah, it's been a bit. We last left off with Reform Judaism, and today I want to shift our focus to American Judaism. In particular, we're going to discuss the name politics of exclusion, the birth of conservative Judaism, which in and of itself might seem like a weird topic, but I'm going to hope to explain today why it's going to be, why it fits, and where it's going to take us for the next several weeks as we discuss, manifestations of the exclusion in America, where you have certainly a more prevalent reform conservative movements in addition to the Orthodox, and a lot of stuff has been happening in America in the past century, probably more than other countries in terms of religious innovation. Well, I guess if not religious innovation, I think certainly more different things have happened here than most other places. Mm-hmm.
That's where we live. So,
well, also that is where we live, but it's still important for historical reasons too. Today's going to be more on the historical side of things, and I put this class together. I have excerpts here from two wonderful scholars. On the source sheets in the back, I have the two sources we'll be using is one, an article by Hasia Diner, as a professor at NYU, like the antelope and the badger, the founding in early years of the Jewish Theological Seminary. It's the first article in a massive two-volume compendium called Tradition Renewed, The History of the Jewish Theological Seminary. Really two massive books on the history of JTS. I recommend people reading it if they happen to have an interest in the history of JTS or the conservative movement, probably too big and too expensive to purchase. The other book is by Professor Jonathan Sarna, American Judaism, A History. This one right over here that I found, I got it when it first came out, enjoy very much. Yeah.
Is he related to Yehuda Sarna, the rabbi at NYU Bronfman Center?
Yes. There is a relation. I forget exactly what the relation is.
Yeah.
But this happens to be a wonderful, wonderful book. And the reason why I'm bringing these two books, these two sources in, is to try to give a contrasting narrative, a contrasting historical narrative, as to how conservative Judaism really started and eventually became what it is. Most of the traditional I think most of the histories of conservative Judaism that I found dealt with the ideology, tracing it back to Zacharia Frankel's positive historical school in Europe, of a different viewpoint of how to express Judaism, how to teach Judaism, which I think there's certainly some truth to that in terms of how the JTS first originated its curriculum and first formulated its curriculum. But I don't think it really helps explain the motivation of why did people, get together, decide to put it, to come up with a new school. I don't think it was that people just happened to have come from his school and said, oh, we need to replicate this in America. As I want to show today, in a nutshell, the basic theory is, and the theory is mine that I'm just using based on the two sources mentioned. They don't say this explicitly, as far as I can tell. It's my own spin, so don't hold them accountable for this. Is that there was an extant American Judaism that Professor Sarna describes in his book, and once you had an influx of immigrants from Europe, both on the Reform and what we would call the Orthodox, that sort of rejected what was already in America for various reasons, there needed to be an alternative. In a sense, conservative Judaism, unlike Reform or unlike the patterns you would find for most sects or most denominations, however you want to classify sociologically conservative Judaism, didn't really start out as we want to be conservative Judaism. It kind of started out with its own ideology that wasn't necessarily incompatible, but it was rejected by the left and by the right and sort of came up on its own.
But it was a middle ground.
It was a middle ground, but it only really formed its own concretized identity because the people on the left and people on the right rejected it.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll talk a little bit later about how, and even just based on that early formation, even though it went through a lot of changes, the fact that it never started out with its own clear-cut ideology has really affected it to this day, where you had, like in the 40s, they were discussing what is conservative Judaism. They were discussing it in the 80s, and every so often they'll say, well, what is conservative Judaism? Because conservative Judaism, it's not just that no one knows. Conservative Judaism never really defined it, you know, concretely for itself. For many years, it was, well, we're not Orthodox and we're not Reform, but that's what they really, yes, that wasn't just how they could describe themselves, but that's what it really was. It was this thing that wasn't Orthodox and it wasn't Reform, and that both sides rejected it for their own reasons. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be the general theory of the class, and going to extrapolate it based on the research of, at least today, based on the research of Sarna and Diner. I recommend people read the full articles and feel free to do more research. And if there are any historians listening to this, please contact me if you've got other ideas or if you think I'm misreading the historical data. All right? So we'll start out with source number one here. First starting off from Sarna 2021. If you're following along with the source sheets, the citations and the page numbers are listed at the end of each appropriate paragraph.
American Judaism.
Yeah.
Synagogue communities, as they developed in the major cities of colonial America, bespoke the growing compartmentalization of 18th century American Jewish life into Jewish and worldly domains. This distinction was unknown to medieval Jewish, or for that matter, to most European Jews of the day, but it was characteristic of American Judaism almost from the beginning. Like neighboring churches, they confined their activities to their own sphere, disciplining some religiously wayward congregants with fines and loss of religious privileges, but leaving commercial and civil disputes, even those that pitted one Jew against another, to the municipal authorities. That's
right.
Interesting.
They
don't have the baked in kind of...
Well, not just that they didn't have a baked in, but, you know, when we were talking about Germany and the Reform Movement, we set up sort of a dichotomy between you were either religious or you were secular. And even going as far back in American Judaism to the 18th century, like it was, as Sarna describes it here, it was unknown to medieval or most European Jews of that day. The Jews in colonial Europe were colonial America, were much more integrated with the secular society. Or by secular society, I don't just mean secular, I mean the non-Jewish religious society than they were in Europe. So they did not have that same sort of dichotomy of an either-or. There was much more integration. Sarna continues, the majority of American Jews resided in religiously pluralistic communities with people of different backgrounds and faiths, including many who had themselves experienced religious persecution. Perhaps for this reason, the Jews, like the Port Jews of Europe, felt more comfortable interaction with Christians than most other Jews did, so much so that we know of Jews and Christians who joined forces in business, witnessed each other's documents, and socialized in each other's homes. When you had the immigrant community in America, you did not have the same religious baggage that you did in Europe. Right, you had a bunch of people, say religious freedom being a big example here. There, because of the religious freedom that America provided, Jews and Christians were more integrated. There wasn't the sense of you had to live under the Catholic Church like you had for centuries in Europe. This was really from square one.
Right, and plus the Jews didn't have to worry about getting put in the tavern by some overbearing ghetto rabbi.
Well, there was that too, but the struggles, the opportunities for religious life in America was the same, in that you were unencumbered by the centuries of institutionalized religion on either side. You also had the same challenges that we're going to see in a little bit too. Let's say here, take Isaac Leeser.
The foremost Jewish traditionalist leader in America for over three decades, was a primary proponent of Jewish regeneration. His obligations as Chazan of Philadelphia's Mikvah Israel were to read the prayers in the original Hebrew according to the custom of the Portuguese Jews, to attend all funerals and subsequent mourning services, with the permission of the congregational officers to perform other life cycle rituals. Within a year, in an effort to strengthen Jewish life through education and exhortation, he began preaching English language sermons on selective Sabbath mornings. He borrowed selectively from a wide range of sources, Jewish and Christian, in an effort to educate and reinvigorate his community. But he carefully reshaped and adapted his innovations so as to keep within the parameters of traditional Jewish practice and law.
Mm-hmm.
He blamed Jews for their accursed love of money, of pleasure, and of power, and warned that the whole regeneration of Israel rests in the basis of the precepts and commandments which we have received as the will of our Father in heaven. That's weird. The guy sounds like an anti-Semite.
Well, it's not so much an anti... I mean, you could say that this is an anti-Semitic trope of a cursed love of money, pleasure, and power. On the other hand, if these were the risks that he saw in his own community,
then
you can...
saying the truth.
Then it, exactly.
Yeah. Yet even as he railed against sin and promoted a return to traditional beliefs and practices, Lisa advocated the Americanization of Judaism. He insisted, for example, that sermons be delivered in English, not in the immigrant vernacular. I think in the East Side they used to have rabbis talking in Yiddish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which would have alienated me because I don't speak that language.
Also, look at, yeah.
Yeah. Most important of all, Lisa reshaped the office of the Chazan in America so that it more closely resembled that of the American Protestant minister. Now, here's a funny thing. I'm used to the rabbi being the big macha.
Mm-hmm.
And here you got a Chazan that acts like a rabbi.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There is hardly any Christian society which does not strain every nerve to have an intelligent and virtuous ministry composed of men who would honor any calling by their acquisition and general conduct, he wrote in 1844. In his own public conduct, everything from his clothing and demeanor to his writings, speeches, and pastoral work, he modeled himself on the practices of the high church Protestant counterparts.
Yeah.
This is news to me. You got a cousin in charge and he acts like a minister.
Okay. Why do you think he would act like a Protestant minister?
He wants to get along with the neighbors that are Christians.
Okay. Why would you think that's important, to get along with the Christian neighbors?
You want to play ball with the community. You're not in a ghetto. Why act like you are in a ghetto? You may as well make friends with your neighbors.
That's absolutely... I think that's a very good reason, certainly a plausible explanation here, in that when you aren't as restricted to, you know, just being Jewish versus, you know, secular, and you're already living in a more integrated society, then, you know, for lack of a better term, when in Rome do as the Romans do.
Yeah.
I'll also throw in another possibility here. The challenges of being religious in America was identical for all religions. In Europe, when, again, you have centuries of dogmatism, either from the Catholic Church or from tightly controlled, long-standing traditional rabbinate, the religious infrastructures were well established for centuries. You go to America, you're starting from square one. So how do you keep people religious or part of your religion when you have the absence of the external social factors there? Right? You can pretty much do what you want. By modeling himself after the Protestant ministers, you're not just doing it to play ball with everyone else. You're also seeing, well, what's working for the other guy? How are they handling the same challenges of keeping people within our respective, or within their flock? What can I do to keep people in my flock? Because you're dealing with a different world.
Yeah.
All right. But I cited this part at length here because it really shows what Isaac Leeser was doing based on Sarna's description, and feel free to look him up for the footnotes, is, you know, by all accounts, he is in content trying to get people to do mitzvot, but in presentation, he's doing it in a way that would be most compatible to his audience. You might consider this, for lack of a better term, modern Orthodox, in terms of how do you keep Torah mitzvot, right? His here, especially the words here, so as he adapted innovations so as to keep within the parameters of traditional Jewish practice and law, right, is recognizing that we have a halacha that needs to be kept, but we can't do everything identically that might have always been done because it doesn't necessarily make sense here.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Very important distinction there. Another point that I'd like to make that I didn't want to elaborate too much on that Professor Sarna does. He in the book, Sarna talks about Sheirit Israel, the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue. Right. And he says here, according to the custom of Portuguese Jews, the based on what he's writing here, the earlier immigrants, Jewish immigrants here, were from the Spanish-Portuguese community. They did not have as much of an issue historically in terms of integrating with the secular world. You had the golden age of Spain, where the Jews were a lot more integrated with the secular learning. We saw several weeks ago the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue in England. I think it was in England, if I'm remembering correctly. But the dispute that we had with the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue, other people coming in and having a different custom there. With the Jews who lived in America, certainly from, this would actually go back as far as the 1600s, there was a lot more integration. From the first paragraph, you see it in the 1700s, that you did not have a clear dichotomy between Judaism and secular. People were a lot more free to be integrated with the non-Jewish world. To the point where Isaac Leeser, who lived in 1806 to 1868, to give you some time context, this was his community, where he felt that, you know, there was a little bit of, that there was going to be a lot more integration, and this is how he handled things.
What bothers me is this absence of rabbinic authority. What kind of a rabbi would allow a chazan to run the show?
I'm not sure who the actual rabbi was at that point. I mean, today,
or even if they had one.
The Chazan, well, we'll actually see that in a bit in terms of the Orthodox side, in terms of, you know, why Chazan as opposed to rabbi. We'll see that in section number two. Mm-hmm. However, in source number four here, this is a very important point. Between 1820 and 1840, according to inexact estimates, America's Jewish population increased fivefold from 3,000 to 15,000. Between 1840 and 1860, it increased another tenfold to 150,000. By the time the first official census, sorry about that typo, of American Jewish community took place in 1887, the American Jewish community's numbers ballooned to about 250,000. Overall, during these years, the American Jewish population increased at a rate that was almost 15 times greater than the nation as a whole. This was largely due to immigration. So you're talking about in a span of 50 years or so, we went from, you know, let's say 3,000 to 250,000. Right. This was during the time that Isaac Leeser was the rabbi in, you know, Philadelphia. Most of these were the immigrants, which meant you had an extant, you know, at least the way that I'm reading it, there was an extant Jewish American minhag, for lack of a better term, that got supplanted numerically really quickly by a whole mass of immigration. I mean, the birth rate, I mean, yes, would account for some of the increase in numbers, but not like this, right? So what was the Orthodox side of things from the immigration side? Go ahead, source number five.
In trying to strike this fine balance, East European Jews had to contend with a religious world radically different from the one they had known across the ocean. The situation in the United States was entirely different. Indeed, what made immigration so dangerous from the perspective of traditional European Judaism was that religion in America was a purely private and voluntary affair, totally outside of the state's purview. Nobody forced Jews to specify their religion. They were taxed and drafted as human being only. When a Jew married or divorced in America, it was state law, not Jewish law, that governed that procedure. Rabbinic involvement was optional. This was not the case in Europe. Partially because of this situation, rabbis could provide immigrants with very little guidance in making the transition from old world to new. In fact, very few East European rabbis even immigrated to America in the 1880s and 1890s. Rabbi Moses Weinberger, one of these few, claimed in 1887 that in all of New York City there were no more than three or four rabbis within the highest level of ordination, allowing them to issue rabbinic decisions based on Jewish law. This in what was already the largest Jewish community in the world. Now, I can see why an Orthodox rabbi would not want to move to the United States. He loses his authority. They're afraid of him in the ghetto or in the small towns that he can rule. Goes to the United States to say, hey, who told you you're
well, that's just not a problem of the rabbis. I mean, you could say, well, the rabbis, you know, should try to go out there to do something together, but this is immigration in general. These are exactly the same problems. Again, if from the European mindset, right, when you basically have that dichotomy, it's an either or. If you're already living in America, it's not as big of a deal because you're a little bit more used to it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But we can already see, at least the reason why I put these in is it kind of shows a little bit of the tension about how did the European rabbis view America based on their worldview.
And my point is that these European rabbis view America as a threat to their authority.
I would say it's more than just a threat to their personal authority as much as a threat to being religious altogether.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even, you know, the fact that, I'll put this, because... Even in Europe, in a sense, yes, because when you're in, if you were in Europe with the aforementioned, you know, historical religious baggage, you're always going to be a Jew, no matter, like, be it anti-Semitic or whatnot. You're always reminded of your Jewish identity, even if you don't keep mitzvot. Even if
you need to say that if I wanted to get married in London or in Paris, I couldn't have a civil ceremony. I was forced by the government of England or France to have a rabbi officiate?
I don't know if it was a purely civil... I honestly don't know the history of...
I doubt it, since Napoleon gave the Jews some kind of... emancipation.
So in this case, I honestly don't know. Mm. In the sense, but I don't know, like... It could have been at that time, even with emancipation and equal rights, you still could have been classified as a Jew, meaning on some papers or documentation, which meant even if you didn't have restrictions, the fact that you still had forced identification, either by the government or by society in one way or another, you know, that you were somehow Jewish, meant that you always retained at minimally your Jewish identity. Whereas if you went to America... You know,
you
forget even just keep,
out.
You can opt out completely, and no one is there to remind you that you're a Jew.
Mm-hmm.
All right? So, what about the reform side in America? So the truth is, you did have some issues in, Leiser's strategy for saving American Judaism did not go far enough for some Jews. They insisted that Judaism itself needed to change in order to survive. They urged Jews to abandon rituals that seemed incompatible with modernity and to adopt innovations that promised to make Judaism more appealing and spiritually uplifting. Isaac Cardozo, again, sorry for the typo, in his address to fellow reformers in 1827, right? So this is already, so keep in mind it's 1827, warned, if we do not adapt things to the existing state of human feelings, then our religion will suffer in the permanency of its sacred character and future usefulness and renown. Such rabbinical interpolations have no support in reason or truth. He predicted would, in the long run, fall of themselves, while the reformed society would acquire power and durability. It didn't work out that way. In 1833, the Reformed Society abandoned efforts to construct a building of its own, and around 1838, it disappeared completely. In Baltimore, a group of German Jews broke away from the Hebrew congregation to protest traditionalist policies, and what members saw as the establishment of the Jewish hierarchy, a reference to the policies of the congregation's defender of the faith, Rabbi Abraham Rice. So there was, even in America, there was seemingly a trend of people to say, you know what, we don't need all of these traditions at all in any way, shape, or form. That at least goes back to, you know, 1827, continued through the 40s, and leading up to, say, the famous Pittsburgh Platform of 1885. Have the link to it to the original sources here, underlined a few things for emphasis. Ed, take paragraphs 3, 4, and 5 of the Pittsburgh Platform.
We recognize in the Mosaic legislation a system of training the Jewish people for its mission during its national life in Palestine. And today, we accept as binding only its moral laws and maintain only such ceremonies as elevate and sanctify our lives, but reject all such as are not adapted to the views and habits of modern civilization.
Mm-hmm.
We hold that all such Mosaic and rabbinical laws as regulate diet, priestly purity, and dress originated in ages and under the influence of ideas entirely foreign to our present mental and spiritual state. They fail to impress the modern Jew with the spirit of priestly holiness. Their observance in our days is apt rather to obstruct than to further modern spiritual elevation. We recognize in all the modern era of universal culture of heart and intellect, the approaching of the realization of Israel's great messianic hope for the establishment of the kingdom of truth, justice, and peace among all men. Was he kidding? We consider ourselves no longer a nation, but a religious community, and therefore expect neither a return to Palestine nor a sacrificial worship under the sons of Aaron, nor the restoration of any of the laws concerning the Jewish state. That's why they call these local shuls of theirs temples. Mm. They don't want to go back to the third temple, so-called.
So in 1885, I just took out three paragraphs here, we have a platform that rejects most of the, well, I shouldn't say most of the mitzvot, but it basically rejects mitzvot that people deem as anachronistic, inapplicable, or...
Stodgy,
impractical, in that there's, you could almost view it as a secular humanistic sense of assuming that the purpose of Judaism is spiritual and moral elevation, we're only going to keep the things that we think provide spiritual moral elevation.
Mm-hmm.
So the attitude of reform, and at least in 1885, expressed is, we don't need kashrus. Bringing back the temple, not going to happen, don't care about that. State of Israel, not that important.
Don't hold your breath. Right.
Listen, this is also in 1885. I can't say that this entirely speaks for Reform Judaism today. It's important to put in that disclaimer. But I'm putting, this is put in here for historical context, as we'll see, about 1886. But in 1885, this was the attitude of Reform. You had, in contrast to the Orthodox, that was scared of virtually any innovation, Reform was very free to just chuck whatever didn't make sense based on their definition as described at least in this Pittsburgh platform here.
Yeah, I want to mention I visited the East End Temple, which is a Reform Gramercy Park area temple, and I see nobody wears a hat there, so I didn't wear one either. And then one guy's wearing a hat. I figured this guy must be a religious nut. Later on, he shook my hand. He's the rabbi. He probably has to wear a hat.
This I don't know. I really know nothing of what's going on internally with Reform today.
Yeah.
But at least then the point was, how do you basically secularize as much as possible? And it was not an uncommon situation in terms of how religion's adopted in America. I'd like to think that there's a very interesting parallel between the Reform attitudes in terms of how they adopted to America and, say, Buddhism, how when it came to America and how it adopted and became, almost New Agey, where, I mean, Buddhism itself is a wonderful test case. I apologize if this is a slight digression. Mm-hmm. It, the way that I understand the evolution of Buddhism is that it really adapts historically to whichever country and the religious models that happen to be in. So Buddhism in India Tibet is different than Buddhism in China, which is different than Buddhism in Japan, which is different than Buddhism in America. And to have parallels between how Buddhism adapted in America and how Reform, adopted in America, I think is a very interesting study.
In case you're interested, I doubt if you'll show up, but there's going to be a Buddhist thing in Union Square today, celebration of Buddha's birthday.
Oh, okay. Good to know. So with this in mind, we get to the creation of JTS. And here the sources will be, whereas all the previous sources, with the exception of the Pittsburgh platform, were from Professor Sarno's American Judaism book. These are from Professor Diner's article. So, on 31st January 1886, so this is a year after the Pittsburgh platform, 12 Jewish men, lay people, and clergy, met in the vestry room of New York's She'irit Israel, right? So this is in the Spanish Portuguese synagogue,
which now is a so-called conservative.
No.
Excuse me, I meant to say is Orthodox.
Yeah.
But I did notice that the rabbi, Mark Angel, the one who retired, he's pretty left. When I heard what he said, I said, you know, you sound like a Reform rabbi.
Well, he's not a Reform rabbi, but, you know, like mentioned, the Spanish-Portuguese tradition, and, you know, reading up the history, you know, of Sheirit Israel, it's really following in a tradition that really integrated a whole lot more in terms of knowing how to be, on one hand, observant, while without... You could be observant without rejecting everything from the secular world, which was not the same type of tradition you had, say, from the Eastern European rabbis. Right? Let's continue with this paragraph here.
Yeah.
That it is significant.
After you finish, I want to throw in something.
But it is significant that they did meet in that shul to constitute themselves as a Jewish Theological Seminary Association. The training of American rabbis was the sole purpose of this body, despite the fact that the delegates themselves and their congregation represented a broad spectrum of Jewish practice. They consistently call themselves Orthodox Traditional, and indeed some refer to their school as an, in quote, Orthodox Seminary. They banded, that should be together, to create a seminary that would keep alive the true Judaic spirit, where the Bible shall be impartially taught and rabbinic literature faithfully expounded. Let's not forget that the term Orthodox was initially coined by the Reform as a pejorative. All right. So when they consider themselves as Orthodox, the point was, you know, they're going to still be completely Shomrei Torah, Halacha u'Mitzvot, but have ordaining rabbis specifically for the American rabbinate. You know, you asked about, you know, why was there a Chazan? You just didn't have the resources for an Orthodox rabbinate available in America, and the ones from Europe weren't so keen on coming to America because of all the risks involved. So the rabbi said, we need a rabbinate for the Judaism of America.
Yeah.
What did you want to say?
I forgot already. Maybe it'll come up.
Okay. Take paragraph 10 here.
Clearly, the founders of the Jewish Theological Seminary envisioned that their experiment in the education of American rabbis would offer an alternative to the Reform Movement's Hebrew Union College, founded in 1875 by Isaac Meir Wise in Cincinnati. The seminary's vision over the course of... I got it. I remembered what I forgot.
Okay.
I noticed that the Orthodox traditionalist rabbis that I know of don't emphasize tikkun olam much. They're interested in more...
They focus more on the ritual than
ritual
they do on these
on
social laws.
People, you know, like look out for yourself kind of attitude. Look out for the New York Jews. Whereas you got the... with the exception of Mark Schneier, who's very to the left, he's interested in a coexistence with Muslims and so forth. Most Orthodox rabbis don't have anything to do with this tikkun olam type spirit. And Mark Angel was a tikkun olam sounding guy.
There are more rabbis out there than, you know, just Rabbi Schneier. There's a lot more out there than you might see.
Yeah, and also this guy Steven Greenberg, who's a an out homosexual Orthodox rabbi, is a phenomenon that I find very attention getting. The guy came out. What the hell can he do? Does he have a congregation?
Not to my knowledge.
It would be difficult. Yeah.
At any rate, so back to topic at hand here. So first off, I mean, there was the Reform Hebrew Union College founded in 1875 in Cincinnati. To the seminary's vision.
The seminary's... You keep my nose to the grindstone.
That's what I'm here for.
I'm more interested in my side comments than disco. The seminary's vision over the course of the 16 years it spanned its founding in 1886 until its organization...
Reorganization
in 1902 bore witness to the assiduous efforts of deeply committed American Jews to steer a course between stupid orthodoxy and insane reform.
I thought you'd like that quote.
Yeah, I like that. Both tendencies, according to the seminary founders and supporters, threaten Judaism in America. What's this, Beck, both?
Because, I'm sorry.
Because both stake out extreme positions and force Jews to choose sides. Neither one could meet the challenge that America, with its separation of church and state, democracy, and secularism, offered to Judaism.
Now, I italicized American Jews. It's the emphasis is in the original. Because in America, the church, the rabbis who lived in the American society, we had much more integration, realized that you can't just have the all or nothing mentality, where orthodoxy, they found, was too restrictive, or at least following the European model, and reform just gave away everything, as we saw from the Pittsburgh platform there of, we don't need to keep kashrut. The dress, all those things are completely irrelevant. There's source 11 here. Rabbis, they believed, who felt equally at home in the world of Western scholarship in the Jewish text, of Western scholarship in the Jewish text, would spearhead the fusion of traditionalism and Americanism. Those rabbis, the product of the seminary, would be agents in remaking the Eastern European newcomers and guiding them into becoming respectable bourgeois Americans who had remained, or actually first become, reasonably observant Jews. Neither Reform rabbis, products of Hebrew Union College, nor Eastern European Orthodox rabbis trained abroad, could handle this task of bridging the seemingly unbridgeable. Seminary activists prided themselves on walking the line between, as Cyrus Adler, a future president of the seminary, noted in 1907, those who had set the model of modernity upon their altars and those who held to the model of the ghetto in the worst period. American Judaism had more to gain, he asserted, by the actions of common sense people satisfied to work together without each one agreeing with everyone's iota of every other man's opinion.
A question came to my mind here. You being an Orthodox rabbi, what in your heart of hearts do you feel about this paragraph you just read? It seems to laud the conservative movement as being more reasonable than either of the two extremes.
So we'll answer that after we let me just finish off with the final paragraph here.
Don't forget to answer.
I promise I won't answer it. I promise I'll get to it. If not, I'm sure you're going to hold me accountable here.
Okay.
So the founding of the seminary committed to this, quote, new spirit draped in the moderation and claiming that rationalism could be blended with tradition immediately caught the attention of both Reform and Orthodox camps. Both chided it for its lack of willingness to state clearly what it stood for, its silence on how the blending would be accomplished. Isaac Mayer Weiss, understandably nervous about a competing seminary that might challenge the primacy of his institution, sneered at those who participated in the initial meeting. He labeled them, quote, supposed Orthodox, rather than being truly observant. The genuinely Orthodox congregations will certainly have nothing to do with men who are engaged and under salaries in so-called Reform congregations and maintain they are building up an Orthodox seminary. On the other hand, Judah David Eisenstein, a figure in New York's Eastern European Orthodox community, in an 1886 Hebrew article, lambasted the founders of the seminary, those who, quote, seek to strike a balance. Actually, they are like the antelope and the badger, which the rabbis could not decide whether to categorize as wild or as domesticated beasts. To Eisenstein, the lack of a firm commitment to real traditionalism or frank admission of reformist impulses constituted hypocrisy. Quoting Diner here, right? So you put all this together, right? And I'll explain like what it means for today because stuff has changed. You had Reform that wanted to, as we said earlier, divest themselves of mitzvot that they didn't want to, exactly.
Right.
You had the Eastern European rabbis who particularly were nervous about any sort of integration, and they saw things as black and white. So, as I mentioned at the very beginning, right, they saw, or at least the founders of what would become the Jewish Theological Seminary, saw that, well, they're two extreme positions, that in America, where we already have a tradition of integrating with the society where it was possible to at least be reasonably observant while also being part of a secular culture, right? Neither one of these is practical for Jewish life. The Reform said, well, we don't want to keep mitzvot, or either we don't want to keep mitzvot or we think it's irrelevant, however you want to describe it. So they're on one side of the spectrum. On the other side, it's what do you mean integrate? How do you integrate? What are the specifics? Because there was no European model at that time, or at least not in the Eastern European model. The only European model you had for the integrationist mentality where you successfully had observant Jews while also partaking of secular society was in the Golden Age of Spain, and all those immigrants were part of the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue, or at least, or not the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue, or of Spanish-Portuguese synagogues, plural, and they were already in America. So you want to talk today about it? Well, yes, if those were your only options, what conservative what the founders of JTS set out to do would be what you would call today modern orthodoxy, right? They didn't call themselves conservative Judaism, right? That term was coined later. They wanted to make a seminary that could train American rabbis that could bridge this gap. But what happened was, you're rejected by the Reform, you're rejected by the Eastern European Orthodox, and these are going to be the bulk of your immigrants, you know, for, you know, years to come. In which case, the extant American Judaism is really going to be overwhelmed by this massive immigration and people coming in which case you now have to convince people to the left and to the right that the middle path makes the most sense. And if you're an immigrant, you might not necessarily care or want that. You might just do whatever you're more comfortable with. Because it's much easier to be an extremist, to say, I'm either going to chuck all of modernity or I'm going to chuck all of traditionalism, than it is to try to bridge it. But because, you know, the critique of Judah David Eisenstein, that they didn't really articulate, well, how do you go about doing this, was a critique that they struggled with really for at least 100 years and then some. Because unless you say, well, here's exactly what halacha is, and here's how we're going to follow it, and here are where we can make the adjustments, unless you have that real sense of, you know, of how you're going to make such compromises, you get stuck asking the same questions over again. So back in the day, you can say, well, there was nothing objectionable from a pure understanding of halacha, but you could understand in the sense why Eastern European rabbis would have been skeptical because they had no basis to say that this could work. Or without a clear deciding factor of, you know, following certain rabbis of like, well, how is this going to work? You just don't know how it's going to work. So what conservative eventually turned into is something else entirely. For that, you'd have to, you know, do a lot more work on, you know, researching all the rabbis, all the decisions that came out, you know, especially after the reorganization in 1902 and Solomon Schechter coming in. There was a whole lot more that came up afterwards. The point of putting it in this section here of In the Politics of Exclusion as the birth of conservative Judaism, this is how it started. And you have a middle path, which you can say they tried to reject the two extremes and to have some sort of a compromise, but conservative Judaism as a denomination didn't start because the people wanted to create a brand new movement. They wanted an alternative, yes, but not to divest themselves from the rest of the other Jews. They wanted, in a sense, something that made a lot more sense, right? You mentioned that great quote about stupid orthodoxy and insane reform, right? Which is one of my favorite quotes in the article. You know, because that's how they saw it. But once you're rejected by the Reform and rejected by the Orthodox, de facto, you have a new movement. They could have just as easily brought in people from both sides, and perhaps they thought, this is what American Judaism ought to be, and we're going to try to, you know, given that there's no other alternative, you know, people have no choice, but we can now create an alternative that might bridge the gap and create a good American Judaism. But if the left rejects you for being too traditional, and the right rejects you for being too secular, de facto, you've got your own movement, even though you didn't necessarily try to be your own movement. Mm. In which case, the formation of conservative Judaism, for as much as people want to tie, you know, the ideological underpinnings to the positivist historical school of Zacharia Frankel, was really because the left and the right rejected them. The Reform didn't like him, Orthodox didn't like him, poof, there you are. And that leads to, I think, a lot of, you know, agita and angst, you know, in decades to come over how exactly do we do it, because they're not going to get support from either one. And not only that, but the other sides would see them as actual competition. Right? So you mentioned, as Diner mentioned, the reform could... you know, could see the JTS as a direct threat to the Hebrew Union College. And, you know, if the Eastern Orthodox rabbis, you know, or the more traditional Orthodox from Europe can say, well, you know, this is a threat to how we want things to go in Europe. So both sides are going to pick on them for saying, you know, you're bad for this or you're bad for that, in which case you have to do that much more work because, you know, both sides see you as legitimate competition. Mm-hmm. And that leads to some really fun, you know, we mentioned earlier that, not earlier, but like one of the themes here is you're going to have the most opposition to the, against the organizations you find to be the biggest threat to you. You know, conservative Judaism, or at least what it became, you know, was based in traditionalism in the sense of following halacha and doing mitzvot. That's what it was based on. And to say that you could follow mitzvot somehow in a different way is certainly going to be, or sorry, is certainly going to pose different challenges.
You can have the Orthodox watching what you say.
Exactly. So as we're going to move on the next couple of weeks with the polemics against conservative Judaism, it's exactly why I find conservative Judaism to be a much more interesting foil for the politics of exclusion, because unlike the Reform that had no problem rejecting mitzvot and didn't really offer a pretense of being a halachic organization, what we call conservative Judaism did. And initially that's what they wanted to set themselves up as, but at least now based on, you know, the back, the historical background of American Judaism provided by Sarna, compounded with the descriptions given by Hasia Diner in her article, you kind of put the two together and you see there was an American Judaism already in existence that people wanted to service that was neither Reform and neither Eastern European Orthodox, that eventually became the institution that we know as conservative Judaism. Mm. Now, granted, conservative Judaism underwent a whole lot of changes, you know, in its history for a whole lot of reasons, which, you know, we might get to, you know, in passing in the other classes. But what they set out to do could equally be considered modern Orthodox. And in fact, following this logic, you might even be able to trace modern Orthodoxy to the Spanish-Portuguese tradition, which I'm not sure if many people do, but it's theoretically possible. At least, this is my theory. Again, take it or leave it. If anyone has any comments, always happy to hear from you. Please send an email, ask whatever questions, because, well, always like hearing from it. And if anyone's got different spins, especially historians of this particular area, I find it absolutely fascinating. Have a wonderful week, and see you all next week. Be well.